I'm Benjamin Wittes, editor-in-chief of Lawfare.
And I'm Susan Hennessy, managing editor of Lawfare.
You're listening to Rational Security on the ER podcast feed.
For more of our columns and exclusive Lawfare content, read us at foreignpolicy.com.
So we've hit the big time. This is the first episode that we're going to be on Foreign Policy's feed as part of Lawfare's like new deal with Foreign Policy. It's very exciting.
It is very exciting. Hello, Foreign Policy ER listeners who are wondering what exactly we're doing on their feed.
Yeah, who are these
Oh, you're
going
to be in for a treat.
Who are these people?
Stick around.
How the heck did you end up
how
on my podcast?
Happen?
Can
Why
I just
are you
say
in my
this
feed?
Is this is the best distribution deal ever because we Foreign Policy is distributing the Rational Security podcast, and we don't even have to read MeUndies ads.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm.
But so we do all get Harry's razors.
A professional will read MeUndies
so
ads.
Can we just say MeUndies?
They might be sponsoring this now, so we have to be very careful.
Not our problem.
We love you guys.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the Smoke and the Gun edition. I'm Shane Harris from the Wall Street Journal. We're here in the Jungle Studio. If there are thousands new people listening to us today, you too will soon know the wonders of the Jungle Studio. Okay, don't start fast-forwarding, please. I'm here with my good friends Susan Hennessy, Ben Wittes, and Tamara Kaufman-Munis. Hi, guys.
Hi, Shane.
Happy day after the 4th. Yeah.
Should we give a little introduction to ourselves for the Foreign Policy listenership that's never heard of us before?
I like to assume everybody is aware of
I mean,
rational
they'll catch
security.
Up, right? I mean, right. You're here. It's an irreverent take on the week's news in national security and foreign policy. Ben runs this blog with a cannon. Like Tammy
Susan's
used to work with, in
spy.
Like some the State Department or something. Susan, I don't know.
Susan
she
used to be a spooky cyber person.
I write stuff.
You know, the usual.
All right, enough introduction. Let's get on with the goddamn thing.
Oh, this week on the podcast, the first signs of potential collusion between the Trump and campaign in Russia emerge. State Department employees say they're uncertain about the future of their work under the Trump administration, and the president is facing a major foreign policy crisis in North Korea as he prepares to meet with world leaders, including Vladimir Putin. You've heard of him. Let's start with, I can't call it the big story of the week because I wrote it.
It was the big story of the week.
It was a big story.
It was a big story.
It was a big story.
Kicked ass.
Yeah, it was a fun week. So for those who missed it, we published a couple stories in the Wall Street Journal about a man named Peter W. Smith, who is a former political operative.
I say former.
Yes, because he's not much of anything anymore because Peter Smith died. But Peter Smith was this Republican operative who was well known in the early years of the first Clinton administration for being kind of a muckraker on Bill Clinton and stirring up controversy around some of his personal peccadilloes, in the most recent campaign cycle an effort to get in touch with Russian hackers who he believed had gotten hold of Hillary Clinton's emails from her private server. And he portrayed Mike Flynn, none other than Mike Flynn, a senior advisor to the Trump campaign, as being someone who was an ally in this effort. This story has come out and caused quite a stir, and I think now people are saying.
Many people think that.
The way that I liked it really well as Chuck Todd put it on Meet the Press is we have smoke and a gun. Now the question is, do they go together? So the question really has become the degree to which, if at all, Mike Flynn and or the Trump campaign was aware of what Peter Smith was doing or coordinating with him or giving him direction on that. I kind of like to just, you know, wonder now the question is, I guess for me is like, where does this story go from here as a reporter? But what has your guys' impression been from the fallout of what we're learning about what Mike Flynn may or may not have been doing with Peter Smith? Also just what Peter Smith was doing, which is pretty extraordinary in its own right. And so far as that seems to me like a form of collusion with Russian hackers. No?
Or at least attempted collusion.
Or attempted collusion, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, on the one hand, it's the kind of hard-edged oppo research that we've seen in American political campaigns since Lee Atwater kind of pioneered it, right? But I think that what's notable here is that in the midst of mounting evidence, which was the subject of public discussion, the Russians were engaged in hacking and interfering in our elections, that this political operative didn't care. He was careless about that interference and perfectly willing to interact with it if it would benefit him. And so, you know, collusion, I think, implies that there's some sort of agreement on the goal or on the objective. And I think maybe alliance of convenience is a mm-hmm. good description here.
So one of the things is, you know, and we've sort of seen a shift in the right wing talking points about, you know, first there was, there's no evidence of collusion. Now there's, well, if it was, if there was evidence, then collusion's not such a big deal. So I think what's significant is that about this particular story is sort of, it represents a new phase in the development of the way we are going to be talking about these efforts of coordination. So collusion isn't really a thing in this context. It only exists in essentially antitrust law. But people have been using the term collusion because they're trying to describe this sort of like big nebulous group of activities that are sort of bad, sort of secret. They're not really using it in a legal sense. Now what we're seeing is the kind of concrete, specific allegations in which you can start to map genuine legal terms onto them. Now you're still being speculative, but legal terms like conspiracy, legal terms like solicitation, all sorts of things that I think this is, I think this story is sort of the first really specific thing on the table that is going to allow us to start thinking in a different way, in a more sort of legally minded way, and especially asking what Mueller's team is thinking about this information, about what took place. Was there anything improper and improper that we weren't already aware of? And was there anything illegal?
So I would say this story, by and large, is consistent with a sleazy operation that's entirely protected by the First Amendment. It's also consistent with a grotesquely illegal and improper operation that you would want to have criminally investigated, and that, and where it is on that spectrum entirely depends on facts not yet in evidence. And let's identify three categories of facts that we don't know the answer to. First of all, what is the real relationship between Smith and the Trump campaign? Mm-hmm. Is this something? And there's a range of possibilities here, right? He could be blowing smoke. That is, we know he knew Flynn, mm-hmm. but we don't know that Flynn was involved in this other than that he said he was, that Smith said he was. So, but secondly, if Flynn was involved, was he involved in a personal capacity, or was he involved as a representative of the campaign, which is the way Smith represented it? So the first is, what's the relationship between the operation and the Trump campaign? Second question is, were they really in touch with Russian hackers who were, state-backed operatives in some sense, i.e. was the other party to these negotiations that they were involved in Russian intelligence? Or was that somebody who was taking them for a ride? And the third is, were there real emails? Or were the emails just a dangled piece of, you know, bait? And I think until you know the answers to those questions, it's pretty hard to know exactly what they were really doing. And I think, you know, there are a few people. Smith had a associate, according to Matt Tate's article, who was working with him on this. This was somebody who's presumably now not dead, who could probably answer some of these questions. Flynn could answer a bunch of these questions. But I think it's probably a little bit premature to figure out which criminal statutes, if any, this maps onto without knowing sort of precisely what happened.
And there's something. Oh, sure. Good. Good.
Well, it's really a question for you, Shane, since you've been doing so much reporting on this. You know, the connection to the between what Peter Smith was doing in the Trump campaign really rests, or seems to rest, in the person of Mike Flynn, at least based on what we know so far. And so, you know, Flynn now cut loose from Trump world, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
What's he saying, if anything? What do we know about what he has said on this that would help us understand that connection?
So on the record, he hasn't said anything, right? I mean, he didn't respond to a request for comment for the story we wrote. Interestingly, the Trump campaign gave a comment, which, and by the campaign, we should say we mean the actual campaign to reelect 2020, which is staffed by people who did work on the 2016 campaign.
Can we just pause for a moment and say that the fact that that already exists
and is already holding rallies
is bumming me out, but go ahead.
On behalf of the campaign, this person said, Peter Smith wasn't working for our campaign, and if General Flynn was coordinating with Peter Smith, he was doing that in his own capacity, not as representative of the campaign, which raises an interesting issue that I've struggled with to try and understand. When exactly does a campaign make that distinction? Is it when it's convenient, or is there an actual line that you can identify when somebody is engaged in behavior X that is clearly not part of the campaign versus behavior Y, which is? I suppose a lot of that answer rests on whether or not there's, documentation of Mike Flynn telling other people in the campaign about Peter Smith, if that were to exist. But effectively, Mike Flynn hasn't said anything so far about this.
But there is one piece of evidence that, strikes me as significant, although not dispositive in this regard, which is Peter Smith had this weird obsession with the idea that Hillary Clinton's emails were, the private server was hacked, and the 30,000 missing emails weren't in fact missing. They were stolen by foreign operatives.
And he wasn't the only person who thought that.
And that was what gave rise to this, this effort. Donald Trump, in July of 2016, gives a speech in which he makes the same suggestion that the Russians, if you've got these emails, please, please turn them over. And over the weekend, a interview with Flynn surfaced in which he said essentially the same thing.
Right, this is from back in August on a show called Caravan to Midnight.
Right.
Which was a new one for me.
And is that like slouching toward Gamar?
Probably. It's in the vein, in the genre.
And so I think at a minimum, you can say that these three people were operating on the basis of the same eccentric theory of what happened to Clinton's missing emails. Mm-hmm. And they all seemed to believe that they had been hacked by the Russians and might become public. And that does strike me as at least suggestive that there may be...
they all as independent...
Smith, as Smith says... They may have been working together.
No. They all independently thought the same thing.
And great each minds,
of,
man.
Each of them individually thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if somebody were trying to find these emails? I wonder if anybody might be doing that.
And so I think you can say, like, to go back to Chuck Todd's metaphor, smoke, gun.
Right.
The question is whether one's coming, or maybe I should say smoke baby cannon.
Right.
The question is whether one's coming from the other.
Right. And I think, yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think just obviously as a reporting matter, that's kind of where we go next. I do want to say one thing on the whole, two things I want to say. First off, I've gotten a lot of questions over how Peter Smith died. I'm going to be very clear. I do not know. We are in the midst of still trying to find the answer to that.
He was 81. Right?
He was 81 years old, but predictably, lots of people on the Twitters and elsewhere have been raising all kinds of nefarious scenarios about how he may have departed this earth. But I do not know the answer to that question. He may have been ill. I don't know. So let's just put that out there. But secondly, the idea that Hillary Clinton's emails may have been compromised before she deleted them, it's not that crazy. I mean, there are, Jim Comey held out the distinct possibility last July that the email server had been hacked. I've casually spoken to very credible people in intelligence and national security circles who say, yeah, it's entirely possible. Why wouldn't the Russians or the Chinese try to get her? So the premise of what they were after, that in and of itself, I don't think was
so far out. My point isn't that the premise is that eccentric. My point is that there's more to the premise that they were operating with than that. The premise that they're operating on is that the server was in fact compromised, that the emails were stolen by the Russians and that they are now recoverable and going to be released in the context of the election. And all three of them are flirting with that premise at exactly the same time. Yeah. And it does seem to me probable that that's because one of them was working to facilitate exactly that outcome.
Right, which brings us back around to, you know, the fundamental question that has dogged the Trump presidency since January 20th, which is, to what extent did Trump or his supporters or his campaign workers willingly participate in Russian efforts to interfere in our electoral process?
And, you know, and that, you know, that Donald Trump is responsible for the people who work for him. That's sort of, that's one of the, like, definitive features of being president of the United States and of being a presidential candidate, that he brought people like Mike Flynn not just into the campaign, but into his security briefings. He hired him as his national security advisor. There's any other number of people that might have been involved in unseemly or worse types of behavior that he then brought into highly sensitive positions in the administration. So this notion of, well, whatever they were doing on their own time, that's got nothing to do with me. No, you are responsible. You are accountable to the American people for what these people did on your behalf. And if you find out that they did something that was not acceptable to you, that they somehow got the wrong message about what you would want them to be doing on their behalf, we're going to need to see a different kind of reaction and response from Trump, both to punish the people who did things that were wrong and also set a very clear message with his staff moving forward.
All right. Speaking of staff and clear messages.
The in the State other Department, direction.
Yeah. The State Department has produced a 110-page report based on a survey that inquired feedback from, this is a pretty astonishing number, 35,836 employees, or about 43% of people who received the survey, basically taking the temperature of the State Department.
But can I just say, did you need $1 million to find out that people at the State Department
Hey, the State Department, this is a highly dispersed workforce. I mean, people had to take trips to hardship posts. Email doesn't get everywhere.
It's funny that this story comes out just now, because just the other day, I FOIA'd the comparable surveys at the FBI.
Were they done by an outside firm for $1.1 million?
I don't know who does the FBI employee.
We should get into this business. Guys.
Seriously.
Yeah. Highly
we should
lucrative.
Do that. I'd take a survey. Well, let's say what the survey said, shall we?
Yeah. Survey said.
I'll just read from the lead from my awesome colleague, Felicia Schwartz, at the Journal. Thousands of State Department and U.S. Agency for International Development employees indicated in a survey that they are worried about the future of their agencies, with some expressing particular concern about lack of support from the Trump administration and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
Can't imagine why. Like, the amazing thing about this is that the administration comes in, OMB proposes a one-third cut in the state and USAID budget. The new Secretary of State walks into the building and lectures his employees about how the campaign is over and they need to get over it. And then they have to hire an outside company to discover that their employees are worried about the future and worried about their leadership.
Can I just point out that one State Department employee who is clearly worried about the future and the leadership is Rex Tillerson?
Yeah.
Because he keeps blowing up at the young twerps in the White House who were trying to boss him around.
We don't know
around.
If he took the survey.
Yeah, so like...
Although there is a great line where they say that the State Department employees were asked to address Mr. Tillerson directly, which they did. Some were highly complimentary and others were, quote, coarse and vulgar.
Wow.
Yeah. I think that there's an interesting kind of breakdown in the survey results, because there's a part of the results that you would have seen under any administration, which is the technology sucks, there's too much bureaucracy, it takes too long to get our travel vouchers through. Like, okay, that's all been true for years. And, you know, part of that is just the bureaucracy of managing taxpayer money and all of the many.
So like that stuff didn't, that was like when you were at state, same issues.
Same issues. Yeah. The IT infrastructure is horrible. You know, the bespoke software packages that you have to use to do your employee reviews are just excruciating to use. Your email storage quota is capped at a ridiculously low level. These are problems that are endemic to the federal government, I dare say, not just the State Department. And they are not at all new. But the findings, on the other hand, that relate to leadership are pretty blistering. Employees saying things like, I don't think that the White House and the Secretary of State understand what we're here to do. And the one that really struck me was at the end of Felicia Schwartz's article, a quotation from a survey respondent who said, basically, we're just a big Labrador puppy and we'd love to jump in your lap. Like, please just give us a little bit of love and respect and we will love you and we will work for you. But we're not getting that. And to me, it was a story about an agency that feels truly abandoned at a moment when you look around the world and we need them to be out there working hard, you know, and that doesn't mean that they have to feel loved and supported in everything they do, but they need some basic guidance. And they need to believe that their leadership knows what they're there for and will put them to work.
This is going to be a very cynical sounding question, but to what extent do you think that people in the White House are reading these survey results and going, great, worked according to plan? I mean, there is this sense of the Trump administration wanting to dismantle state, not filling, you know, many, many of the positions in the sort of sub-cabinet levels. I think a lot of people believe that Steve Bannon, you know, just essentially wants to dismantle the apparatus. There was this enormous budget cut that was proposed several months ago. Do you think people in the White House are reading these results and sort of, you know, patting themselves on the back?
I think the president is of multiple minds about this at the same time. So on the one hand, you know, he does say, you know, I don't want to fill these jobs. And, you know, dismantle the administrative state, that sort of stuff, although dismantle and administrative state are words that are a little long for him. So he leaves saying that to Bannon. On the other hand, if you watch his video when he went to the CIA, it was important to him to say to the CIA workforce something that is almost surely not true, which was that I know you all voted for me.
Right.
And he actually – it was important to him to bask in the adulation of the eight people in that audience who were excited about him or the however many there were. They were loud. And I think, you know, he holds in his mind two ideas at the same time. One is that he's making America great again, and the people who do U.S. foreign policy are all behind him. And the other is that, you know, to the extent they're not, that's because they're Obama holdover evil deep staters who are stopping America from becoming great again. And I think those two ideas really do coexist for him.
You know, I guess I wondered, even if all that's right, how does that match up with Secretary Tillerson's incredibly deliberate and very drawn out effort to reorganize the State Department? I mean, clearly he took the job with the mandate to cut the budget, to consolidate, and to reorganize. But the way he's going about that, sort of, okay, announcing he's going to do it, taking the budget cut, but then he's doing the staff survey. There is going to be a set of working groups under the Deputy Secretary of State to investigate how to reorganize. They're going to present a plan in the fall that, you know, Congress is going to want to look at as it sets the budget. And then they're not going to implement anything until next year. And in the meantime, Tillerson implied when he testified on the Hill that he might leave a lot of these senior sub-cabinet jobs vacant while he figures out the reorganization. It's like this very extended management consulting, thorough approach, as opposed to what Bannon wants to do, which is just disrupt, which is just like... Yeah. You know, or what Trump may feel, which is, I don't need professional negotiators in the foreign policy bureaucracy. I'm the negotiator and Jared's the negotiator. You know, so it's like, why bother going through this reorganization exercise?
It's a really interesting point, too, because I've wondered to what extent does Rex Tillerson, and I think we're seeing the signs of it, we talked about this last week, looks at Jared and others in the White House who are clearly engaging in high-level foreign policy discussions, whether it be with the Saudis or the Israelis or the Palestinians, and kind of says, like, well, what am I doing here? Right. I mean, I'm only running the diplomatic arm of the government.
I'm in charge of the reorg.
Right, and that you can constantly be second guessed and undermined.
Right.
And
it's
that at best, you have the second to last sort of bite at the apple because somebody else has the ability to come in and change the president's mind.
Tillerson has an extremely important role in the Trump administration, which is he runs the organization that doesn't write all the visas. That's the State Department's job in the Trump administration.
Is to not issue visas.
I do think it's also important to look at Tillerson to some extent for what he is, which is an engineer. I mean, by training, he was an engineer with Exxon. He came up through the ranks. This is, you know, Steve Call writes about this in his book, this highly regimented company for which there is a manual for like everything, right? And so as an organizational task, it seems that reorganizing the State Department, which come on, it's something that lots of other secretaries have tried to do, Colin Powell, others, et cetera, is probably something that he's pretty well suited to. But most of them tend to delegate that to, you know, a deputy and kind of go about the business of foreign policy and of statecraft from the position of the secretary's office, which is apparently not happening.
I wouldn't say it's not happening. I think that he has been given two significant tasks. One is dialogue with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov on sort of how to reset the U.S.-Russia relationship. And the other is leading the civilian side, along with Mattis, who's leading the defense side of this U.S.-China strategic dialogue, the first round of which just took place the other week. And so I think he does see himself as having some diplomatic meat to his job. But I guess what I find striking is the culture clash between that sort of engineering, rules generating, let's regularize approach, and the culture of the diplomatic corps, which to its credit is spitballing. It's like the world is a complicated place. Things happen really fast, throw you in the deep end and we'll scotch tape it all together and make it work. That's how the State Department has run for decades. And that's actually a culture that people there are very proud of. And so it seems to me that to the extent Tillerson is genuinely and sincerely trying to turn this place into a procedures-based, regularized organization, that culture clash is going to be pretty fierce.
Yeah. Well, let's pivot on to actual statecraft, shall we?
We don't do statecraft anymore. Come on.
Well, we're going to have to start. Guess what? So yesterday, the 4th of July, happy 4th of July, North Korea launched a missile that Rex Tillerson actually came out and confirmed is, in fact, an intercontinental ballistic missile. This is happening on the eve of President Trump going off to Poland first, and then he's going to be in Germany for the G20, where he is going to have a face-to-face with Vladimir Putin. A lot to unpack here. Quickly, I just want to touch on the North Korea issue because we have a real crisis brewing as this kind of diplomatic event happens, which I think many people are expecting the G20 to try and be. Well, the question is, will President Trump try and make this a reset of his last trip to Europe? But we'll get to that in a second. One question I just want to put to you guys, how significant is it that this is a confirmed ICBM launch by North Korea?
But one thing to note is the DOD actually used different terms. So they said that it was an intermediate range, which is different than an intercontinental. Right. So it's even for something like this, where the terminology is so significant, it appears that sort of state and DOD do not have sort of their ducks in a row on it. So who knows what the actual official statement will be at the end, but already we're seeing some sort of weird mismatch in the terminology they're using.
Right. And it matters, actually, because whether this was a two-stage rocket that in theory could get across an ocean from one continent to another, or whether it's, you know, it's something that we recognize as a reliably intercontinental device, matters because preventing North Korea from getting ICBM capability has been a major tripwire for previous American administrations. It's been the thing that we've been trying to prevent by trying to deny them missile technology by, you know, using sanctions, pressuring the Chinese, et cetera.
Plus, Trump tweeted that it will not happen.
He said it will never happen. And look, a few months into his term, it's happened. And so if you recognize this as ICBM capability, then it's a major advance, and it sort of demands a major American response or ratcheting up. If you don't, if you say, well, it was a two-stage missile, but we're not really sure it can do much and it was really inaccurate or whatever, then you can push it off and keep working on your policy review. But I think that this was big enough, and more importantly, the kind of escalation in North Korean behavior and the repeated rocket launches are important enough that they are going to demand a significant American response.
But what are even really the options? And I say this, you know, decidedly not as any kind of North Korea expert, but what are, right, so we sort of know the general range of possibilities because it's something past administrations, many past administrations have struggled with, something between sort of military action on one end and doing nothing or soft sanctions or sort of asking China to do something on the other. That was all before there was a belief that they had sort of nuclear capabilities. So now they have a nuke and potentially or even probably a way to deliver it. How does that meaningfully change the set of options that should be on the table for responsible countries? You know, if let's assume that they do have a nuke that they can deliver somewhere in the United States.
They do have nukes that they can deliver. They can't deliver them to the United States, but they can deliver them to South Korea, Japan.
Right, but that's been true for at least a number
of years.
Well,
they could put on a boat and deliver it to the United States,
yeah,
presumably.
Right.
But.
You know, North Korea, you know, red alert, newsflash, it's really dangerous. And they're scary people, and we like to pretend they're comic for some reason, but there's nothing comical about them. Mm. The most important thing they have is not nukes. It's thousands and thousands of artillery pieces pointed at one of the most densely populated cities in the world and a major commercial hub of East Asia. And they can kill a lot of people on very, very short notice, and they're absolutely morally capable of doing it. And that's the fundamental problem. But there is this one tool that, you know, people have stopped short of using because it's a flashpoint in U.S.-China relations. But you could start sanctioning Chinese banks. And we sanctioned one little one. You know, people who believe that there's something you can do about North Korea, and of course that's a hypothesis, not a certainty. Everybody who believes that seems to believe that the country that can actually do it is China. And so the question is, what's the incentive structure in which China would take a more aggressive posture toward North Korea than it has? And one possible way to think about that is to start sanctioning Chinese businesses that are actively involved in business in North Korea and to ratchet up the pressure on China. Now, that has collateral consequences for all sorts of U.S.-China relations that are separate from North Korea. But I think that's probably the direction that people are thinking, and it was certainly on the table in the latter years of the Obama administration.
Well, so first of all, I think that the options for U.S. policy toward North Korea are the same as they've been, and they're all bad. And that was true for the Bush administration. It's true for the Obama administration. It's true today.
True for the Clinton administration.
Yes. So, you know, the sort of turning of the screw on China as a way of trying to increase the effectiveness of denying North Korea access to resources and technology is, you know, it's kind of the least change in the current approach. And you're right that it could have collateral consequences for other dimensions of U.S.-Chinese interests. But in fact, what President Trump's signaling, if we t- take his tweets as evidence of policy, which, you know, we've debated before on the show, and I think we probably have to at this point, is that Trump sees those other issues in U.S.-Chinese relations as leverage he can use against the Chinese. So going into this G20 meeting, one of the big questions on the table is something he's been hinting about, which is whether he's going to declare Chinese steel unfair China unfair in its trade practices with respect to steel exports to the United States and impose tariffs on Chinese steel. The other countries of the G20 probably won't go along and do the same thing, but it would have a significant effect on the U.S.-China relationship, and it might be something that he sees as leverage against the Chinese on North Korea. In addition to which, the U.S. conducted a freedom of navigation exercise, its second in the last month, in East Asia this week. And, you know, so there are other ways that the U.S. can ratchet up the pressure on China. The question is whether there's clear kind of trade-offs with the Chinese that can be worked out, or whether this is just sort of an escalation in tensions in the hope that China will, quote, do the right thing on North Korea, unquote, without specifying.
Right, but sort of, it doesn't appear as though Trump has laid the groundwork for any kind of productive, even getting tough with China, right? He's sort of...
For a real estate guy, laying the groundwork does not seem to be his forte.
Right, but like, you know, right, you know, is he going to, declare Chinese steel a threat to national security? It's basically the same conversation he had with regards to, is China a currency manipulator, right? Where he sort of uses this vague threat, then is, you know, educated, previously by the Xi Jinping visit, on, well, what that actually means, and then says, oh, never mind. And so he's already sort of burned his credibility with China in a number of confrontations, beginning with sort of the initial call with the Taiwanese president, you know, moving up into this currency manipulation and the conversations that occurred during the Xi visit. And now we're sort of in the next iteration of that. So if you were China looking at the history of your relationship with Trump, I don't know why you would believe him to be sort of reliable in his threats or somebody who's even capable of being tough on you, especially whenever we know that that whatever meaningful choices he takes against China are going to come with real costs to him and real economic costs and real political costs, both at home and abroad. So I don't see him having made those moves or laid the groundwork for that signaling at all.
Tamara, as a political exercise and a diplomatic one, how important is it for Trump going into the G20 to try and hit the reset button? I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of people in the White House who think that's the last thing we want to do. Coming out of the last meeting in Brussels, this is great. You know, we've
all the Europeans are nervous. We like them that way,
right? Exactly. I mean, so what are we? Or what do you think that people are expecting or hoping to see from him on this trip? I mean, to Susan's point, I mean, I think that the question of consistency and reliability. I mean, I don't think anybody, any of these powers presume that there's any consistency or reliability in the administration. There's been no evidence of it. So what do you think people are hoping for going into this meeting?
Well, I think that's actually a really important point, because whether you're a competitor or even an adversary of the United States, or whether you're an ally, a lack of a sense that commitments from the U.S. are not reliable, or policy declarations are not reliable, is a huge problem, because you don't know how to behave. Or you might simply conclude from that no matter what the president of the United States says, he's not actually going to get in your way. And so you can go ahead and do whatever you want. And so, you know, if what we see is a Trumpian approach that involves trying to have functionally cooperative relationships on major issues with China on the one hand and Russia on the other, and there is going to be this Trump-Putin bilateral.
Leave them alone together.
Right.
We should place bets now on whether or not they are left alone together.
That's a great question,
too. I'd put 20 on a private meeting.
The readout of that meeting, and who's going to have the more detailed one, us or the Kremlin.
Right. And I think that what we've seen repeatedly from Trump in his bilateral engagements, whether it's with the Japanese Prime Minister Abe at the very beginning or his trip to Saudi Arabia, is that the governments he's interacting with have their asks. They know what they want from the United States. They come into these meetings with very clear asks, and Trump doesn't have an agenda. In fact, on the Putin meeting, the National Security Advisor as much as said, we don't have a concrete agenda for the meeting. I don't think the president has an agenda. You know, so his real agenda is, I want you to treat me like a big deal.
Yeah.
I want you to say that you love me. And so what it means is that these other governments are easily able to sort of trade that approval, that stamp of approval, for their specific asks, and Trump gives away American leverage again and again.
He gets played.
He gets played. And I think this is the danger that a lot of European governments see as Trump goes first to Poland before he even gets to the G20 meeting. And he has an opportunity there to either send some strong signals about Russia's role in Eastern Europe or not, right? Repeat his commitment to NATO and to Article 5. Or not, right? Tout Poland as a counterbalance to Russia, or tout it as a counterbalance to Germany and Angela Merkel. So I think that Europeans really see this trip as like walking the knife's edge. And one way or another, by the time it's over, they're going to know what to expect from him.
All right. Let's move on to object lessons. I'll go first because I think Ben has the best object. So I'll just go ahead and get mine out of the way. So it's not often that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Corps publishes things to its website, right?
This is the most secret court in the country.
Right. It's the super secret rubber stamp court. No, it's not a rubber stamp. It's not a rubber stamp. So a group called...
Potato stamp.
What's that?
It's a potato stamp.
It's a potato
the
stamp.
The kind you made in preschool? Yeah. Oh, great.
I tried to make one of those ones and it didn't work. I was just never good at those projects.
FISA court is actually not a stamp of any kind.
Right.
But if it were going to be a stamp, stop calling it a rubber stamp. It's such a cliche. Let's go with woodcut stamp or potato stamp. Or
I like that. A woodcut. Yeah. A woodcut. The woodcut stamp of the Fisk. It received a motion from a group called Landmark Legal Foundation to appear as an amicus before the court, in which the Landmark says, respectfully urges the court to exercise its inherent authority to protect against the administration of justice the integrity of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and direct the federal government to conduct a thorough investigation into leaks.
That is not how that works.
Right. So there's that, right?
at all.
So you can't file a motion to appear as an amicus before the court to have the court direct the government to investigate leaks coming out of probably not the court, but probably somewhere else in the government about FISA. And there were so many ways that the FISA court could have, they could have said, dude, not how this works. Try again. Go read Constitution, whatever. But they just reported back and they said, the court order says, although presented as a request to appear as a friend of the court, there is no matter pending before the court with respect to which such an appearance would be proper. Which is almost kind of like saying, don't know what you're talking about.
And who the hell are you?
What are you talking about?
I just thought it was just weird and delightful. And you can go read it on fisk.uscourts.gov.
And you too can file a completely random amicus brief to the court.
No, it's a motion
right,
to
the,
appear.
The motion to appear.
It's not
and
even
ask
a...
them to litigate your marital disputes or whatever other random issue.
And if you're Louise Mensch, you can ask them to issue secret indictments of the president.
of the grand marshal of the grand jury. I can't remember. The sergeant in arms.
We need to get a woodcut stamp from the Fisk that just said, not how this works.
Well, maybe we should start a hashtag for people who want to suggest things for the Fisk to do. How about hashtag the Fisk should? Mm-hmm. And then you can send your suggestions of things the Fisk should undertake to hashtag
my dog.
The Fisk
should. Disputes with your neighbors
and
mad at Uber.
And if we get good suggestions for the Fisk over the course of the week, we'll read them next week on Rational Security.
That is some of the problems you'd like the most secret intelligence court, secret court in the land to solve. Ben, what's your object?
So a number of weeks ago, as listeners may remember, I received a package with a tiny little cannon.
You received a package. You mean
you requested it, purchased it, and then it came.
And last week, apropos of Shane's story, Rachel Maddow went on television and did a inexplicably long discussion of my tendency to tweet tick, 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 which I formally retired last week. And as
it's explicable. It's because she loves it.
Okay, well,
it was so good too, by the way. Her windup was great.
Shane was on the set at the time.
Yeah, I was literally like standing by waiting to go live with her and cracking up. It was just great.
So in the course of doing this, she showed a number of times the video that I had made, which I used for the tick, 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 boom, is the little tiny cannon, which I call baby cannon, obliterating a can of Dr. Brown's Diet Cherry Soda. And
hates that soda.
Yeah.
Grossest of all sodas.
Baby Cannon does not like Diet Dr. Brown's Cherry. So in response to this, Baby Cannon received a just wave of Twitter love. I love the Baby Cannon. So Baby Cannon was very moved by this. And spent some time this weekend creating new videos in my neighborhood. Mm. Five of them, to speak.
Some people have dogs who are Instagram stars. Some people make cat videos. Ben makes baby cannon videos.
Yeah,
and it was 4th of July, so blowing stuff up in the neighborhood.
Exactly.
Is
so we blew timely. Up. We blew up an egg. We blew up a piece of dry ice. We blew up a light bulb filled with red, white, and blue glitter, which you can see on we tweeted it out for 4th of July. We blew up a can of Silly String. And then the really special one, which I'm going to save, I'm afraid, for a really good story that requires a special boom, blew up a can of expandable foam sealant. And it was just a thing of beauty.
And just a program note for everyone out there. Expandable foam sealant, we learned, will adhere to plant life.
Yeah, it made quite a mess in the front yard.
And listeners, if you have other suggestions for things that Ben should blow up at the home he shares with Tammy, please send us our way. Yeah. She'll really
and
appreciate
I will
it.
Deep six every idea.
I just want to point out that every single one of these baby cannon video was suggested by somebody on Twitter.
The internet just gives and gives.
It gives and gives.
Giving.
So from Baby Cannon to all of you, thank you.
And thank you to all of you for listening. That brings us to the end of the show. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find our show archive at our webpage. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security, or you can send us things that you want Ben or the FISA court to blow up, for that matter. Go for it. Have at it. Let us know. Whenever you download the podcast from Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or your favorite podcatcher, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. Leave us one that Baby Cannon would be proud, very proud to show us his own.
Boom.
It sure helps other people find the podcast. And to all of our new listeners, we are very glad that you're here. Our audio engineer this week is Matt Kahn, filling in for Quinta Jurassic. Our show is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell. Our music was performed this week by Rex Tillerson and the Disappointed Diplomats.
Aww.
Aww. It's a blues band. No, our music is performed, as always, by Sophia Yan, who, you know, doesn't play blues as far as I know, but probably would rock it if she did.
Yeah, she should do some of that.
She should.
Sophia can do anything.
She can do anything, including blow up whatever she wants. On behalf of my friends Susan Hennessy, Ben Wittes, and Tamara Kaufman Wittes, I'm Shane Harris. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.